The call went down the lines, hundreds of men dropping to their knees as the Guanero and foot soldiers marched onward. Fire! Though the Empress's cry was lost amongst the screams of the approaching slaves, the archers got the message anyway, unleashing a flock of arrows toward the wall's ramparts. Several enemy archers were hit, one tumbling off the wall and landing face down on the ground, his body crushed under the trod of a guanic, snapping as it passed. They rode along the shadow of the wall, the stone blocks even larger from close range, taller than any of them, even while mounted. The wall rushed past in a blur. From the left, the slave riders danced deftly between them. Wheeled carts clattered behind the horses, attached with short ropes. Raven was surprised to find all the riders to be women, their faces spotted with strange black markings. Except for one, a dark-haired, young-looking man with white fear in his eyes, which were larger than most Phoenicians. He rode behind one of the women, his arms roped around her stomach. And then they were gone, skidding to a stop near the foot of the wall. The man dropped from the horse into a fighter's stance, while the woman landed lightly on her feet beside him. She screamed something, but her words were lost to Raven as Ichnon thundered out of sight. The stone gave way to a thick sheet of iron, the first of four gates built into the wall. Protected by the Guanero, Fire dropped from her steed and pressed her hands to the gate. Jaijaru. Everything had gone according to plan, until it hadn't. As Jai had suspected, none of his people had taken his offer to turn back. Even Joaquin had clasped his shoulder and said, "You may be a soft-hearted Paizan killer, Jaijaru, but I will not leave you now." The people were quiet as they exited the rocklands, moving across the desert plains like ghosts. Not so much as a single baby wailed in the night. The horses' padded hooves were mere whispers in the dirt, and Shanti's cart creaked so softly the sound was lost on the wind. The lights of Susa sparkled to the northwest, but they were well clear of the war city, aiming their path for a point on the wall somewhat east of the iron gates. Jai led them, targeting the spot based on what his father had said. "The hollow in the wall is 100 paces east of the easternmost gate, northeast of the famed war city of Susa." Though he believed his father, his trust didn't stop a deep pit from forming in his stomach, growing larger with every step. What if he was mistaken? What if Vinhosa had since had the wall repaired? What if a fire arrow strikes our barrels of fire root before we reach the wall, sending us all into the void? What if this journey was all for nothing? What if, what if, what if? This is my destiny, right? He didn't have the time for such thoughts, because they were approaching the wall. He saw fire to the right, the glint of steel in the light of the moons, shadows moving, some of them larger than others. "What the void?" Sonica Vade said, noticing the same thing. "An army," Shanti said. "We have to leave the people behind and open the wall." "Wait, look," Sonica said, pointing. A flag flapped in the breeze, displaying a sigil. A dragon rising over a red sun. "Calypsians," Jai breathed, incredulous. "How is this possible? What are they doing here?" Before he could contemplate further, the wall's armed defenders began shouting, having realized what was happening. Arrows flew through the air, landing amongst his people. They dropped in droves, screaming. Running now, charging the wall in a mass of humanity, stumbling over the dead. Shanti grabbed Jai around the waist and scooped him up onto her horse. She spurred her mare forward, while the other tiers did the same, charging for the wall. "I have to go back to my people," Jai cried above the pounding hooves. "There's nothing you can do for them now," Shanti said. "The wall is all that matters." Truth burned in Jai's heel. And then the Calypsian army was among them, flashing past. One of the soldiers held a flaming sword, her red leather armor smoking. She was surrounded by Guanic, the reptilian steeds of their Southron neighbors. But none of that mattered. Like Shanti had said, nothing mattered but the wall. If they couldn't breach it, they were all walking corpses. Jai almost flew from the saddle when Shanti's horse skidded to a stop on command, but her strong arms held him back. He flung a leg over the side and landed naturally in Fen Lu defense stance on the ground, while Shanti came down lightly beside him, immediately untying the ropes wrapped around the barrels in the cart.
"Help me!" she shouted.
But Jai was already grabbing one side of a barrel, lifting it while she did the same on the opposite side. The other Tiers gathered around them, firing arrows toward the top of the wall, picking off enemy archers. They hefted the barrel into position.
"Is this the right spot?"
Shanti asked as they set it down.
"It's the best guess I have," Jai said.
The knot in his chest grew thicker.
"Then it'll have to do."
They went back for another barrel, then another, placing them in a neat row. One of the Tiers had fallen, a dreadnoughter, an arrow protruding from her stomach. Even still, she continued to fire from her knees.
"Get back,"
Shanti ordered.
Jai rushed back amongst the Tiers, while Shanti uncoiled a large length of twine, shuffling backward.
Arrows rained down upon them, and another Tier went down. Sonika, the arrow's feather protruding from her shoulder. Jai knelt by her side.
"Help Shanti, not me,"
she gasped.
"She's our only hope."
"I won't leave you," Jai said, grasping her under the arms and helping her to her feet. Nearby, the other Tiers were doing the same for their other fallen sister. As one, they fought their way back from the wall, reaching Shanti as she finished unraveling the twine.
"Light it,"
Sonika said between gritted teeth. An arrow flew past, narrowly missing Jai's hip. Shanti struck her flint, and sparks flew. One of them caught the dry twine, smoking for a moment before bursting into fire. The orange flames danced along the rope, running toward the pocket of barrels. More arrows soared down from above, but they were no longer aimed at them. They were aiming for the rope. Someone had realized what was happening, and they were trying to stop it, to break the twine with a pinpoint shot. Those Tiers still capable of shooting fired another volley of arrows at the top of the wall. The flames were halfway to the barrels. Jai looked back at his people, who were still charging the wall, stumbling over bodies.
"So few," he thought,
tears blurring his vision. Though there were thousands, it was like their numbers had been sliced in half. "The rest are dead or injured," he knew. "Women, children, men, good people. My people." Jai held out his arms as they approached, as if he was going to hug them all.
"Stop!"
he shouted. Somewhere behind him he knew the flame was still making its way toward the kegs of fire root. The people crowded against them, jostling from behind, driven by panic and fear. Those at the front tried to hold back the mass of humanity, but slowly it pushed forward, and then... boom! Compared to the blast that had caved in the entrance to Garadia, this explosion was an act of the gods, a giant hammer pounding the earth. The force of it was so strong, it was like a shove against Jai's back, throwing him into the churning mob of people. They went down hard, a tangle of arms and legs, their cries swarming together like a hive of bees. Stone shrapnel fell like rain, piercing their skin, bruising their bones. Jai covered his head with two hands until it was over. Dazed, he fought to his feet, trying to make sense of the fog swirling around him. Smoke, he realized. The acrid stench curling his nose. An arm grabbed his and he whirled, Shanti. She wasn't grinning this time, although the explosion must have sent a thrill through her gut. There was too much death and destruction to smile. Maybe ever again. But still, some of them were alive, which meant there was hope. Only a sliver, perhaps, but better than nothing.
Go!
Jai roared, pushing her toward where he thought the wall was. She looked back at him, surprised.
"I have to stay with my people. You finish the job," he said.
She nodded and turned away, off to find her remaining barrels hitched to her horse. Jai reached down and grabbed the nearest person he saw, pulling her to her feet. Next, he picked up a fallen boy, his face smudged with ash and blood. It was Jig, his eyes wide. "Follow the others," he said, giving him a shove. More and more people charged for the wall, which was just coming into view as the smoke cleared. Jai couldn't believe his eyes when he saw it. For amongst the shattered stone and mangled bodies of the archers who had fallen from high above during the blast
was the truth of his father's words. The wall was like a cracked eggshell drained of its yolk, yawning open to reveal a narrow hollow in its centre. A way through. Already Shanti and the other Tears were hauling the fire-root kegs into the stone corridor.
"Run!"
Jai shouted, reinvigorated, shoving bodies toward the gap in the stone. A pair of forms materialized in front of him, as if born from the rising smoke itself. One was a boy wearing a dark cloak, his pale head shaved to the skin. The other wore a grey cloak that shrouded his face, not a shred of skin visible beneath the thick cloth. The boy spoke, his voice deeper than his age would suggest. "Our plans have changed. You want peace? Infect the slave army," he said, speaking to the hooded man beside him. The beggar. It would be so simple an act. Pull off his gloves, throw back his hood, and touch them. If he infected enough people, the plague would spread out of control like a wildfire, burning Fanes alive from the inside out. The Empire would fall. With one side of the Southron civil war destroyed, the fighting would have to stop. Peace would reign in the Southern Empire once more. He would be using his power to do good. Right? That's what Bane told him.
"My friend. My brother."
All it would take was a simple touch, and then Bane could save his energy to kill another warmongering ruler.
"Peace will dawn upon the Four Kingdoms before winter comes."
The beggar pulled off his gloves and threw back his hood. Though chaos ruled the night, smoke hanging in the air, mixing with the screams, one man stood watching him. His eyes were too wide to be fully Phoenician, and yet he was no slave like the others, his skin tanned rather than red like the Terran's. He spoke. "Who are you?" The beggar glanced to the side, but Bane was gone. Had he abandoned him?
"No," he realized. "He trusts me to carry out the plan. He has other work to do."
The beggar stepped forward, hand outstretched.
"I am a friend," he lied.
The dark-haired man moved closer. He had a knife in his belt, but he didn't draw it. "I have to go," he said. "My people are escaping through the wall." The beggar frowned.
"Escaping? But they are slaves. Vinhosa's slave army. They are supposed to be fighting the Calypsian army, enacting violence, threatening peace. I am supposed to stop them. But if they're not fighting, then why am I here?" "Who am I?"
he murmured, feeling empty inside once more. "What?" the man said. "I don't have time to linger. Our window is closing."
"No,"
the beggar said, and he wasn't sure if he was speaking to himself or the man.
I...
He took another step forward, so close now that if he were to lunge, he would almost certainly make skin-to-skin contact.
"Do it."
He knew the voice was in his head, inexplicably, but still he whirled around, looking for the source of the command. He cradled his head.
"No, no, no, no,"
he muttered.
"Do it."
The man said, "Are you hurt?" His expression of concern was too much for the beggar, especially because of what he was about to do.
"What I have to do. What I was born to do."
He lunged, and the man was so surprised by the move that he froze, not even trying to get out of the way. The beggar snatched the knife from its scabbard. Jai Jaru. The unnaturally pale man had his knife, brandishing it before him. His grip was at an odd angle, but still, one cut and he'd be finished. There was something off about him. "It's fine, I'm not going to hurt you," Jai said, casually falling into defense stance. He could easily take the knife away. Disarming a foe was one of the first lessons you learned in Fen Lu. Not to hurt them, but to subdue them. Somewhere nearby there was a second explosion. Shanti. She did it. A swell of satisfaction rolled through him. Some of his people would escape. So many were dead, but not all. Not all.
"I know,"
the young-looking man said.
"Then why are you doing this?" "Because I must," because it is who I am."
He raised the knife over his head, the blade cast in green light from Luahi shining from high above. The beggar. This was all the beggar had left.
"This is who I am. I am no killer," he whispered. "Not any more."
No, he was a boy again, not scared of his shadow any more, but innocent. He was the boy his mother had once named, the last word that passed by her lips before the evil inside him had killed her.
"I am not the beggar. Not any more. This time he would truly kill to save thousands of lives. I am Chavos."
And he brought the knife down, stabbing it into his own gut. Jai Jaru.
"Oh, gods, he's killed himself."
The man fell, blood dripping between his fingers, watering the dust with crimson rain. Jai rushed to his side, preparing to put pressure on the wound, to do everything in his power to staunch the flow of life, to save this stranger, this—
"Stay back!"
the man hissed, kicking out a boot. So startled was Jai by the sudden attack that he stopped dead in his tracks.
"I am the beggar of Calypso, the plague reaper, the destroyer of souls. I have murdered thousands in cold."
He gasped, his lips and eyes widening in tandem.
"The beggar," Jai thought. "So it's true. He is the origin of the plague."
The man's voice weakened.
"I am lost. Don't let him emerge victorious."
"Who?"
Jai's voice was a whisper.
"The mad one. He will destroy us all."
"Who will? Emperor Hosa?"
The beggar shook his head slowly, his eyes fluttering closed.
"No. My brother. The king's bane."
His body convulsed violently, his back arching, and then he went still. He was gone. When Jai finally managed to climb amongst the rubble of the wall and navigate the narrow passageway, the majority of the survivors were already through, as well as the Black Tears. Shanti waited, breaking into a grim smile when she saw him.
"I feared you were dead."
"I survived a hungry red paizan, remember?" Jai said. "Everything else is child's play." Shanti hugged him fiercely, surprising him, and it took him a moment before he squeezed back. Together they stepped over the final stone blocks and into the west, a land of freedom. Jai's eyes darted to the top of the wall, but it was empty. There was no one left to stop them. Jai's people were laughing and crying, celebrating their freedom while mourning those they'd lost. Jig ran up, and Jai stooped to embrace him, spinning him around. Viola was next, and then Morella, followed by dozens of others. Even the Dreadnoughter twins, Gorin and Orin, came to him, though they clasped his arm rather than hugged him. Jai forced himself not to count the survivors, but it was clear they were less than 1,000, a mere fifth of the number they'd left the Red Rocks with. The mix of joy and sadness was the most conflicting feeling he'd ever experienced. Sonika approached, and he reached out to clasp her arm. She pulled him into a hug, whispering in his ear,
"You did this, my friend."
"Thousands dead, all to save so few. Is this what I've done? Is any of this worth it?" Jai pulled back. "No, we did this." She nodded, and Jai was about to embrace her again when he heard a shout. Together they turned, locating a commotion near the destroyed portion of the wall.
"Go back," someone commanded.
Jai recognized broad-shouldered Joaquin. Just beyond him was another man, his brown skin sheened in ash and sweat as he stumbled over the blocks.
"Axa.
He made it." The former master held his mirror aloft, talking into it, oblivious to Joaquin's position in front of him. Joaquin shoved him back when he stumbled into him.
"Wait,"
Jai said, stepping forward between them.
"I'll kill him if he doesn't turn back," Joaquin said. "I swear it. So many of our people are dead, and he's alive. It's not right. What kind of justice do the gods give us?"
The man's face, though stoic, was laced with sorrow, a miasma of anger and sadness and guilt and regret.
"I'm sorry," Jai said,
"but more killing isn't the answer." Joaquin dropped to his knees, all fight having left him.
"Then what is the answer? Why must humans treat each other this way? Why must vermin like him survive, when good men and women do not?"
"Only the gods know," Jai said.
"I'm sorry,"
Axa said from behind. Jai turned, at first assuming he was talking to his mirror again. But no, Axa was looking directly at him. Slowly, he turned the mirror around.
"Sorry,"
he said again.
"Jai Jaru,"
a voice boomed from the mirror. Subconsciously, Jai took a step back, because that voice. A powdered face appeared in the reflection, smiling. Diamonds sparkled from his chalk-white skin. His narrow eyes bore into Jai like twin blades. Emperor Hoza stared at Jai, and then he said,
"Slaves! Capture Jai Jaru and the Black Tears. Bring them to me."
Jai whirled around, not understanding, trying to make sense of the senseless.
"Yes, master,"
the slaves said in unison. Joaquin was the first to grab Jai, and he didn't struggle, not as dozens more piled on him, binding his arms and feet. Nearby, Shanti's eyes were wild as she was bound too. Sonika fought like a tigress, but was eventually subdued. The rest of the tears were also captured. Jai lay in shock, his cheek pressed against the ground. What had happened? What had Axa done? Was this his fault? Axa turned the mirror back around.
"You have done well, slave," Finhosa said. "I will consider reinstating you as a master."
"Thank you, master,"
Axa said. Jai closed his eyes. 40. The Northern Kingdom, Castle Hill. Anis Gerick. Anis felt numb. Bodies littered the castle grounds. Hundreds. Old men who should have been living out the last of their days next to warm fires. Young boys who should have still had their entire lives ahead of them. Seasoned warriors who had fought in and survived numerous battles, only to fall under her watch. Too many. She'd lost all but 7 of her army. Utter annihilation. And yet, they'd emerged victorious. No matter how hard she tried, she couldn't seem to reconcile the two conflicting truths. Losing Sir Craig, her aunt's husband, hurt the most, especially because he'd been killed in the battle's waning moments, while carrying out her plan. Is victory worth the cost? She wanted to look away, to hide her eyes from the truth before her, but instead she planted her feet on the wall and stared down at the carnage, at her dead, at the remains of each of the monsters they'd slain. They'd fought for her. They died for her. She could have just relinquished the crown to her uncle and disappeared, and then all of these people would still be alive.
"Why did you do this, uncle?"
There was no answer now, nor would there ever be. Sometimes men were just evil in the core of their souls, this she knew. Her father was one like that. Her uncle was another. But if she had not fought, had not risen to the occasion, the kingdom would be doomed. She had to make their deaths mean something. She had to bring peace to the north for the first time in a century.
"I did as you commanded, Your Highness," Samet said, approaching.
"Good,"
Anis said, without looking away from the corpse-littered courtyard.
"Thank you."
Samet, as always, had been eager for her orders, even after the long, exhausting battle. Anis had immediately sent him to the castle pond to send a stream to Blackstone with the news of the Imposter King's downfall and that Anis had reclaimed the crown. The message ended with an order to cancel the attack against the west across the Bay of Bounty and for 9/10 of the northern army to withdraw. She hoped she'd been quick enough and that an alliance with the west was still a possibility, regardless of Queen Rhea Loren's stubbornness.
As queen, Hanisi's first order of business would be to refortify the borders at Darin and Raiders Pass. From there, she wasn't certain what to do next. Hanis also had Met stream a message to the east, informing the ironclads of the change in northern leadership, and warning them not to attempt an assault at Raiders Pass nor Darin. She hoped it would work. It would take time for her troops at Blackstone to complete the journey to their eastern borders. Taryn hadn't stopped moving since the battle ended. Hanis watched as he strode from body to body, salvaging their weapons, which he knew they might need for the rest of the army when they arrived in Castle Hill. There was a pile for swords, one for armour, one for boots. The men kept their uniforms and personal possessions. From there he would throw a man over each shoulder, and sometimes one across his back too, and haul them to a growing pile. Carrying three at a time, Taryn looked huge. Well, huger. Though previously she thought her eyes might have been playing tricks on her, how could a man as large as him get any bigger? Now she was certain. He was bigger, at least by a head, maybe more. A mammoth end of a man. "What is happening to you, Taryn?" For the first time since she'd known him, he'd made no move to replace his helm or to pull his mesh mask to cover his face. Although she was certain he was aware of her gaze, he never looked up at her, continuing the work that would break a lesser man's back, heaping hundreds of bodies in a pile. "He's preparing a funeral pyre," Anise thought. In the north, the ground was generally too hard and frozen to bury a body, so fire was used, the ashes scattered in the frozen lake or on the wind. It was said that if the ashes were deemed worthy, they would be taken up into the clouds, becoming part of the snowfall. If unworthy, they were sent to frozen hell, where the person would form once more, only to live out 1,000 lifetimes in misery. Anise hoped both her father and uncle were enjoying the fruits of their labours. "Taryn," she thought, her eyes never leaving him, "come to me." She knew he would not, not until the fire burning inside him had been extinguished, the voice quieted. Until then, he would use his aggression to carry bodies. Dietrich and three of the four men he had left were off somewhere in the castle, searching for servants and other castle workers who might still be loyal to Lord Griswold. If any were found, they were to be brought to Hanis for interrogation. The fourth surviving soldier had been sent to retrieve Archer, who had been left with a small contingent of guards. Sejonius was still a bear, but he was growing smaller by the moment, resting against the wall beside the funeral pyre. Though his numerous wounds were serious, he wouldn't allow anyone to touch him. He, like Hanis, refused to take his eyes from the desolation he'd been a part of. Zelda sat in the puddle that used to be her husband, staring at something perhaps only she could see. A sound finally pulled Anise's attention away from the yard. She looked back over her shoulder to where the city was spread out below her, a series of stone buildings connected by uneven cobblestone streets. Several soldiers, including the one she'd sent, moved slowly toward the castle. Behind them was a train of carts bearing the tradesmen and women who'd travelled with the army from Gearhead. Hanis immediately spotted the blacksmith cart, where Fay sat working on some new design, the next version of Evenstar, perhaps. Her gaze moved on, toward the front of the line of carts, until she saw a horse attached to a cart laden with supplies. For some strange reason, she expected to find Archer awake, and her heart leapt in her chest. But no. He was unconscious, his form as still as the dead. Anise sighed, making her way towards the steps that led down from the wall. Sir Metz was still standing at attention, as if awaiting her next command. "At ease," she said. "I have no need of your service right now."
"Thank you, Your Highness. I will polish my armour as I await your call."
"As you wish, sir," Anise said.
For once, his armour did need a good cleaning. "Be sure to obtain sustenance as well." He bowed and descended the stone steps. Hanis made to follow him, but then stopped when movement in the city caught her attention. It wasn't the guards leading Archie's cart up the lane, but behind them. Someone else, stepping from one of the buildings. A man wearing a thick coat and scarf.
A woman crowded behind him, equally dressed for the weather. They peered after the soldiers and cart. Others emerged from hiding, citizens of the north, gazing respectfully after their beloved prince, the one they always hoped would one day be their king. Anise tried to take a breath, but couldn't seem to get her lungs to work. Finally, the air shuddered through her throat. Despite all the people below her and the height from which she stood, she felt alone and small. It was as if now that she was back in Castle Hill, she was that broad-shouldered princess again, who preferred wrestling with the boys in the yard to dancing at the winter ball. Unlikable. Unlovable. Destined to be Archer's awkward older sister. What's her name again? And then Zelda was beside her, sticking her jaw out defiantly. A moment later Sir Dietrich appeared, along with his men. Sir Metz, his armour still unpolished, returned next. Sir Jonius, who was a man again, save for extraordinarily hairy arms and legs, strode up the steps and fell in line. His chest was laced with gashes and spotted with bruises, but his thick bearskin had protected him enough that he would survive. He couldn't seem to form a smile, but his eyes were the same, always the same, as he nodded to her. Anise nodded back, and then looked around, expecting Taryn to come next, but he was still toiling in the yard, sweat dripping from his brow. She wanted desperately to go down those stairs, to meet Arch's cart, to shake him until he awoke, to beg him to tell her what to say to the people gathering outside the wall. His people. Even now, even as the queen, she couldn't think of them as hers. She gritted her teeth and stuck out her jaw, and planted her feet on snowy stones, willing her toes to grow roots. I will not leave this spot until these people are my people. The soldiers led the horses and cart train through the gate, but Anise didn't watch them. Her eyes were focused on the people milling about below, stamping their feet in the cold, their breath misting from their lips. Once they had stopped moving up the laneway and were gathered tightly together, she spoke.
"I am your queen," she said. "I will not fail you."
She had an entire speech planned out in her mind, all about how she would be better than her father, how she would listen to her people, how she would reduce their taxes and protect them from enemies both within and without their borders. But she never got to give that speech, because it was after only those 9 words that the people began cheering and stomping their feet. They raised their hands toward her, their fists clenched.
"Queen Anise,"
they sang.
"Queen Anise."
A tear trickled down her cheek. Later that day, Anise sat beside Zelda. They stared at their reflections in the puddle, which had reformed into ice as the temperature dropped. The iced-over puddle was all that was left of Sir Craig.
"Aunt,"
Anise started to say, but Zelda cut her off.
"Did I ever tell you about your uncle?"
"Lord Griswold? What about him?" She frowned. Her uncle had never been warm toward her, and frankly, she didn't care. She wouldn't mourn his passing.
"No. Helmuth," Zelda said.
Anise shook her head, wondering where this was going.
"All I know about Uncle Helmuth is that he left Castle Hill long before I was born, after Grandfather skipped over him in the line of succession. She also knew he had been born with a lame foot, which was why he was remembered as the Maimed Prince, a nickname that had always bothered Anise. Surely there was something more important to remember him by than a deformity from birth."
Zelda nodded.
"That's correct. My father was a difficult man, but at his core, his heart was gold. It just needed a little polishing before you could see it. In the end, he regretted the way he'd treated Helmuth. He hated that he'd driven him away."
She paused, seeming to collect her thoughts.
"Unlike Griswold and Wulfric, I never despised Helmuth. We weren't friends, exactly, but we played together sometimes. Games of the mind rather than of the body. We were closely matched, but he usually won. Your Uncle Helmuth was clever. He might have made a good king in another world."
Although the story was fairly interesting to Anise, she'd never heard anyone speak a good word about Helmuth. She still didn't understand her aunt's purpose in telling it. And one thing she'd learned from spending time around Zelda was that she always had a purpose.
"This isn't another world, though. It's the only world we've got."
Zelda offered a toothless smile.
"My point is, I mourned Helmuth when he left, just as I grieved for my father. We all mourn differently. I choose to remember all the good, because most of people have plenty of good in them, even if they do foolish things from time to time. Craig had the most good of any man I've ever met. He was the only man who looked at me and saw me. Really saw me. This thing is rare to find."
Anise nodded. She knew that as well as anyone. Terrin was the only one who'd ever made her feel that way. Zelda continued.
"Craig lived a good life. Half the time he was scared of his own shadow, and yet he refused to hide from the sun. He took chances he never had to take, risked his life for what he knew was right. He fought to the very end."
"I'm sorry I thought bad things about him," Anise said. "I'm sorry I believed him to be a coward."
"Don't be ridiculous," Zelda said. "You couldn't have known. My husband was a talented actor. When he was drunk, Craig, he hid his honour in his false flask. When he was Sir Craig, he hid his fear behind his shield. He was one of a kind, and he always had affection for you. He told me many times how much he believed in you. As queen, as a person. He did."
The thought made tears well up, and Anise let them drip down her cheeks and splash onto the ice.
"We all do. Why the frozen hell do you think we're here fighting monsters? Well, besides, for the fun of it."
Anise laughed and hugged her aunt, who, despite her jape, was also crying. They held the embrace for a long time, remembering Sir Craig, remembering his sacrifice. Anise was worried about Terrin. Well, more worried. She was used to how he would pull within himself after a battle, but he never avoided her for this long.
"Give him time,"
she kept telling herself. But after a week with no communication...
"I'm losing him,"
she realized. "Enough is enough. No more waiting." So she went to him. Sir Metz insisted on following her around as her personal guard, and she was too exhausted to begrudge him the honour.
"Wait here,"
she told him, as she entered the small underground room. He didn't object, although he didn't seem that keen on leaving her side. The room had once belonged to the potion master, old Darkspell, who Anise had been frightened of as a child. It was his potion that had created the 99 monsters that had devastated her army. Unfortunately, when Sir Dietrich and his men had searched the castle, they'd found no sign of the hunched old man. His supplies were gone, too, leading them to believe that he'd fled as soon as the battle began, perhaps even earlier.
A wise move.
Anise would have seen him strung up by his wrinkled old toes for what he did. Now, Terrin had claimed the room for his own, spending hours in the dark, not even bothering to light a candle or lamp. It was here that she found him now, his back resting against the stone wall, his elbows on his knees, his head stuffed between them, eyes downcast. Though he still wore his armour, his helmet was off, his head and face exposed. Despite his size, his strength, his armour, he looked so vulnerable it almost brought a tear to Anise's eyes.
"Leave me,"
he said, as she shone her lamplight across him. His voice was a shadow of the man she knew.
"No,"
she said, still fighting back tears.
"I am dangerous."
"Yes,"
she agreed.
"To our enemies."
He shook his head, looking away once more.
"To everyone. To myself. To you. This thing inside me. I can't control it. I thought I could, but I was wrong. It controls me."
"You weren't wrong."
Anise placed the lamp on the potion master's empty table and strode to Terrin, grabbing his chin in a tight grip. His eyes met hers.
"I love you,"
she said, her voice trembling. Only as she said it did she realize it was the first time she'd told him. Why didn't I say it sooner? A tear trickled from his eye, meandering down his cheek, changing direction each time it crossed one of his protruding black veins.
Look, Taryn, she said, whatever is happening to you, we can face...
His expression changed in an instant as he cut her off.
You have no idea what is happening to me,
he growled. He reached up and touched her jawline, which still bore the long shadow of a bruise. His touch was too tender for the words he'd just spoken, and they made Anise shiver.
You say you love me. Then you have to let me go. I cannot put you at risk any longer.
What? Let him go? Taryn, no! I won't! I can't! I am—
The Queen, he interrupted. And I am a distraction, and a dangerous one.
She'd had enough of this talk.
Do you love me? She said.
You know that I do, and—
Then what else is there to talk about?
It's not that simple.
He raised his hand as if to touch her. She wished he would touch her, but then let it fall to his side.
I am the only one of my kind, and no one, myself included, knows what I'm capable of.
You're not a monster.
Tell that to the monsters I slayed during battle.
We all killed them. We all became something other than our normal selves. That is war. It'll make monsters of us all.
But I'm different, and you know it.
I've been told the exact same thing my entire life, but I'm not running away from you.
But you're not. Stop!
Anise grabbed his chin beneath her hands and kissed him. He hesitated for a moment, but then kissed her back, roping his hand around the back of her head, his fingers nestling against her scalp, pulling her toward him, like he couldn't breathe without her. Like she was an addiction he couldn't get enough of. His other hand found her hips and maneuvered her against him, into his lap. She slipped her tongue into his mouth, and as her fingers traced hot lines down his jaw and along his neck, he groaned. A quarter hour later they were both warm and sweaty, and though still fully clothed, it didn't feel that way. Anise nestled into the crook of his arm, not minding even the hardness of the armour beneath her head.
"Glad we settled that," she said.
Taryn sighed.
"That was an evil trick,"
she laughed.
"But it worked, didn't it?"
"For now."
"We'll talk later. And by talk, I mean remove our clothes."
He shook his head again, but didn't argue further.
"Now I've got a few matters to attend to. Would you like to come?"
"No, thanks. I might soak in a cold bath."
She smiled.
"Is that my fault?"
"Completely."
"Good. I'll have Dietrich melt some snow. See you later?"
He nodded. Samet seemed anxious when she finally emerged from the room. Well, more anxious than usual. "The stream has arrived," the knight said. "It's from Blackstone."
"Good," she said. "We need information."
Metz led her up the stairs and along the stone corridors. Though it had seemed like night in the dark potion master's room below, above ground it was midday, white sunlight breaking through the thick grey clouds. It was in the throne room that Anise found her guardsmen and aunt gathered, standing in a semicircle around the throne. Their stares found her, their expressions serious. She climbed the dais, but didn't sit.
"Did you read the message?"
she asked Sir Dietrich.
"Yes."
"And what does it say?"
He pursed his lips briefly and then said, "Blackstone has fallen." The words made no sense.
"Fallen? But my uncle had thousands of soldiers there, the entire strength of the North. That simply cannot be."
"The truth is hard to hear sometimes," Zelda said. "That's why so many people avoid it."
"It is signed by 6 separate lords," Dietrich said, showing her the bottom of the letter.
"As Lady Zelda said, it is the truth. Northern forces crossed the Bay of Bounty at full strength. Your uncle planned on taking Knight's End and then marching south. Hundreds of warships sank.
No soldier was left alive, save for the ones Queen Loren sent back across the bay to tell the story of her victory. It is said a creature of the deep rose up and decimated our armies. It is said Rhea herself controlled the creature. Frozen hell. First her uncle's army of monsters, and now this? The Four Kingdoms had descended into chaos. We have no army. I am looking at the entirety of our strength in this one room. Well, except for Taryn. Anis felt the room begin to spin. She took a step back and sank onto the throne. "All is lost," she said. "Your Highness, if I may." Sir Jonius stepped forward. He was completely back to normal now, the monster potion having worn off days ago. Anis couldn't speak, but she gestured for him to go ahead. He cleared his throat. "These are perilous times, and your uncle was taking drastic measures." "I hadn't noticed," Anis said dryly. She wasn't in the mood for a recap of the carnage her uncle's monsters had wrought on her army, nor more talk about Blackstone. Jonius soldiered on, unperturbed by her weary tone. "Toward the end, Lord Griswold was obsessed with an ancient scroll he'd found locked away in your father's private collection." Anise frowned. "What scroll?" "It was a map." "What map?" "A map to the Sleeping Knights." Anise breathed out heavily. "They are a children's bedtime story." "Your uncle didn't think so." "My uncle was a fool." "Now, that is the truth," Zelda said. "But that doesn't mean he was wrong." Jonius took another step forward. "He was an evil man, yes, like your father, and perhaps a fool. But he certainly believed in this bedtime story, as you call it." Anger swirled inside Anis. "If you believe my father and uncle were so evil, why were you their stepping stool for all these years? Why did you kill on their behalf? Why did you betray me? Yes, you helped us in the end, but do you think that makes up for everything you did? All the atrocities?" Anis realized she'd stood up at some point during her tirade, her hands fisted at her sides. Jonius only looked sad. He said, "My wife was sick." Anis paused, glancing at her aunt. Zelda shrugged. Apparently she wasn't aware of this information either. Anis said, "I didn't know you had a wife. I never saw her in court." "She was bedridden for many years." "I'm sorry for that," Anis said, still wondering how she could have been ignorant to so much about this man's life. "But what does that have to do with your actions?" He told her everything. About how years ago Darkspell had formulated a tonic that kept Sir Jonius's wife alive. How first the Dread King and then the Imposter King threatened to cut off the supply if the knight didn't obey their every command. Sir Jonius began crying partway through the story, and that was when Anis knew exactly how it would end. "When did she die?" she asked. "Your wife." Sir Jonius blinked, unshed tears sparkling in his eyes. "A fortnight ago. First I tried to escape, but your uncle's men caught me, imprisoned me. Then I tried to take my own life, but I failed. Or perhaps I was too cowardly." "You are no coward, sir," Anis said. "You proved that with your valor during the battle. I would be dead if not for you. We all would." He shook his head. "I want to be tried for my crimes against the kingdom. I will admit to them all. I have not forgotten a single one." Anis descended the steps, one at a time, slowly. She placed a hand on his shoulder. She felt as if her heart was cloven in two, first by Taryn's words, and now by this knight's. "I will not try you for crimes you were manipulated into committing by my father and uncle." As fresh tears bloomed, he shoved his knuckles into his mouth, biting down hard. When he removed them, he said, "My wife is dead. She was my life, my everything, as pure as freshly fallen snow. And I keep asking myself, why am I still alive? Is this my punishment? What is left for me to live for?" "I don't know," Anis said, "but you are alive.
And if you cannot live for yourself, Sejonius, live for me. Serve me, and I will do everything in my power to rebuild our great kingdom, with you by my side."
He shook his head, but Anice knew it wasn't his answer.
"Good," she said. "Now show me this scroll of yours."
Calling the scroll a map was being generous. Yes, it showed landmarks like the mournful mountains and frozen lake, but beyond that it was difficult to discern. Clearly Sejonius was correct about its purpose. "Sleeping Knights" was written in flowery calligraphy near the top of the map, right above a spot labelled Cavern of the Ancients, set deep into the hinterlands, further north than anyone had ever explored, at least as far as Anice knew. There was one great explorer, however, Heinrich Gehrig, the same Crimean explorer who'd originally discovered the Four Kingdoms, who'd led a party far to the north in search of gold. No one really knew what had happened to him, and that was 500 years ago anyway. On the other hand, the legend of the Sleeping Knights was no secret. One of Anise's childhood nurses had told she and Arch the story many times, upon request. The 1,000 knights were said to have been the elite soldiers of the early northern kingdom, established shortly after the first Gehrigs had splintered off from western rule, declaring their independence. Anise's ancestor, the fourth Gehrig ruler, King Brown Gehrig, was said to be a strange man, a superstitious recluse who dabbled in sorcery. After his elite squad was formed and trained, he'd supposedly found a way to grant them immortality, so they would always protect the North from invasion. However, what he didn't know was that once they were made immortal, they would leave him for the hinterlands. According to the legend, they'd left because they were not truly needed, and only when they were called upon in the North's true time of need would they rise up again from their slumber.
"A bedtime story," Anise said again, sighing.
"Perhaps," Zelda said.
"Perhaps not."
Anise looked to Sir Dietrich.
"What do you think?"
He looked surprised to be asked for advice.
"The only other option is to begin training new soldiers from the cities. It will take years, especially because we have so few knights left to train them."
Anise didn't have years. She might not even have days. The North was ripe for the taking, and as soon as the rest of the Four Kingdoms realized it, they would swarm through Raiders Pass and grab Castle Hill by the throat.
"I don't know that we have any other choice," she said.
"I always wanted to meet one of the Sleeping Knights," Zelda said,
brushing a finger across the spot on the map. Hours had passed since she'd left Terrin, but finally Anise and her inner circle agreed to sleep on the choice of whether to pursue the supposedly immortal Sleeping Knights, and make a final decision on the morrow. Now she sought him out once more, determined to talk some sense into him. He wasn't in her quarters, like she had hoped. She asked several people, but no one had seen him. Grudgingly, she traipsed back down the steps into the darkest part of the castle, seeking him in the potion master's old room. She scanned the room. Empty. Memories flashed of Terrin sitting in the corner. How he'd kissed her, breathed her in. How he was like kindling to the fire inside her. She frowned, and was about to turn to search elsewhere when she saw a sliver of parchment peeking out from beneath the table. Evidently a gust of wind had blown it to the floor. She stooped and picked it up, the paper slightly crinkled, as if it had been splashed with moisture, only to have dried. Her heart stopped. Her breath caught. Her fingers shook. All she'd read was the very bottom, where Terrin's name was signed in neat lettering, just beneath the words, "Goodbye, my love." Hot tears splashed on the page as she read the rest.
"My dearest Anise, you are perfection exactly the way you are. While I am a broken man, this monster inside me has eaten too much of my heart, my soul, and I fear my every action. Being reunited with you gave me hope, with your every word, with your every touch, that I could be fixed. You made me better. But alas, it wasn't enough. I continue to have hope for the kingdom, however, as I know you will be the queen you were meant to be, the queen the realm deserves. My greatest sorrow is that I will not be there to see you rule, to share your embrace, to feel the touch of your beautiful lips upon mine. Our time together was too short, too hell-frozen short. I would gladly die for one more day, one more night, but I will not risk your safety for my own selfish desires. I will cherish the time we had, the memories. Do not seek me out, for you shall not find me. Perhaps in my solitude the monster will retreat into the dark hole it emerged from when I drank the witch's potion. But please, do not wait for me to return, as I don't expect I ever will. Find a suitor who will love you the way I have. Goodbye, my love. Terin Shiri, the Armored Knight.
She placed the note gently on the table, using her dress to wipe it clean of her tears. Then she dried the tears on her cheeks. Memories flashed through her mind. Building a shelter on the howling tundra together, sharing body heat all night. The first time they'd kissed, after the battle at Raider's Pass. His japes about her being the bear slayer. The pink hope flower he'd pressed into her hand. Their first night together. The passion they shared. The love. Their embrace had felt like a fire that could never be snuffed out, but which was now a wet pile of ashes, leaking smoke. She remembered what she had thought while riding, how she would rather die than live without Terin. Now, as she faced that exact scenario, she wondered if she'd meant it. Was she like Sir Jonius? Her lifeblood connected to that of another person so deeply that without him she was lost. She thought of the people of Castle Hill, chanting her name while she stood high on the wall. Not Archer's name, but hers. No, she thought fiercely. She was saddened greatly by Terin's departure, almost as sad as she had been when her mother had been executed, but no, she didn't want to die. No, her strength, her life, was not tied to one man or to any man. It was tied to something inside her, an inner strength she never knew she had. Not until now, anyway. I am the Queen. She didn't need some silly title after the traditions of her father and grandfather, like the Undefeated King or Dread King. No, I am Queen Anise Gerrick, and that is enough.
41. The Southern Empire, Fanes, the Southron Gates. Raven Sands. Fire had easily melted the first of the four iron gates, the liquefied ore pooling on the ground, cooling rapidly and forming a metal floor. At some point there had been an explosion, and then another, but from where, Raven knew not. From there, fire led their forces west along the wall, toward the next of the gates, nearly a day's march away. They took heavy fire from the wall's defenders the entire distance. Arrows, heavy stones, and vats of boiling tar rained from above, killing many. But still they marched, as Sarai arced overhead, cooking them alive in their leather armour. It was almost as bad as the desert, worse, perhaps, because they couldn't stop to rest. Twice Raven deflected arrows with her shield. Being on the enemy's side of the wall had its advantages, however. Thrice small forces of chalk-faced Phoenician soldiers sallied out from Susa and attacked in the typical Fenru style, spinning wooden batons capped with blades on each end and using acrobatic manoeuvres. But they were ill-prepared for a full-scale assault on their side of the wall, and Goggin and his Guanero were able to repel them without taking a significant number of casualties. Also, fire sent platoons of soldiers up the stone staircases, where they fought along the wall. Eventually, Fire and Raven took to the wall as well, using the high ground to move quickly across the borderlands. To the north were the four western border cities, Vinya, Saris, Cleo, and Felix, the counterparts to the Phoenician war cities. Beyond them were the Forbidden Plains, an infernal stretch of uninhabited land meant as a buffer between Fanes and the west. Up ahead, a large enemy contingent blocked their path, but fire launched several fireballs, scattering them off the sides, where they fell to their deaths. Raven's sister's words came back to her. I am a weapon. Indeed she was, Raven could not deny it. But still, it didn't mean fire wasn't more than that, too. When they returned to Calypso, she would convince her of that, beating it into her head if necessary. Their warriors and Guanic were weary, but still fire led them onwards, toward their goal.